Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Hi, this is Greg Bresnitz, one half the host of Snacky Tunes. We have had the honor of being nominated by Taste Awards for Best Radio Show and Best Podcast. Please head to bit.do/stvote in order to vote for Snacky Tunes and other food favorites. Once again, that's bit.do/stvote. And a big congratulations to Heritage Radio Network for being nominated into the Hall of Fame. Thanks so much. We really appreciate it.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth, Wisconsin, makers of the world's best cheese and pioneers in the U.S. artisan cheese movement. For more information, visit rothcheese.com. Hey everyone, this is David Tatasciore, lead engineer and studio manager of the Heritage Radio Network, and I'm reaching out to ask for your support during our end-of-year fund drive. A contribution in any amount supports our weekly programming and our mission to make the world a more equitable, sustainable, and delicious place. Plus, you'll receive exclusive member benefits like monthly playlists, discounted event tickets, party invitations, and more. So, if you like good food and you love good food radio, throw a little dough our way. Make your gift at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Happy holidays from all of us here at Heritage Radio Network.
We talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Darren Bresnitz, sitting in the gorgeous Cannibal restaurant out here in Culver City with Francis J. Derby.
Francis J. Derby.
What's the J stand for?
John.
Grandfather? Father's name?
I'm a junior, actually. It's my father's name.
Okay.
So I was named after my father, and my father was named after my uncle, Fran.
Can I ask?
You can ask.
Is there a pressure that comes with being named after someone else, like, so directly?
The only pressure I'd ever thought about with that is if I were to one day have a kid, is it on me to name my kid Francis John?
I don't know. How do you feel right now? In this moment, how do you feel?
I don't feel like I'm having kids, so.
Okay, there we go. All right. So maybe then, like, your next restaurant will have to be called, like, the Francis J. Derby.
Yeah, right. That'll be my next kid.
Isn't a bad name for a public house or a pub or something like that. Or even a steak, like a really high-end steakhouse. So, Francis, we met...
Years and years ago
in New York, and I feel like I'm doing more interviews of New York guys out in California.
Right.
But we met years ago on the... Early sets of Dinner with the Band.
Yeah.
I met you through one glorious Sam Mason.
Yep. That was the first the first episode you guys shot before, I guess, it got picked up, right?
Yes. Yes.
That was fun. That was my first food styling gig.
I remember cooking, like, I don't exactly remember the set, but I think it was like two burners and like a grill top.
It wasn't a kitchen.
It was not. It was like literally on the bar.
Like a warehouse/studio. Yeah, I remember.
And so you're from New York through and through. Long Island.
From Long Island. Yeah. From Long Island. Grew up there. My whole family's there. And moved to New York when I was like 20, 21. So 17 years ago.
But growing up in Long Island, was New York always the beacon? When you're in Long Island, are you like in Long Island?
Of course.
Like, cut to the shot of you in your room and like the distant, you know, New York City lights, which doesn't make sense geographically, but...
Yeah, not geographically. I'm more like, I'm an hour and a half out on the South Shore. More of like a little, kind of, you know, white picket fence.
Yeah.
Beach town. But no, the thing was, yeah, the first person that got their license, it was off to New York City for all of us, you know, which was my friend. I think my friend TC, he was the first of us to have a license. So the second he had a car, we would all pile in the car every Friday or Saturday and go to the city and not know what the hell we were doing.
What did you do?
Nothing.
Nothing.
We drove around. Really do much as a 17-year-old that knows nothing about the city.
But did you eat slices of pizza, things like
that? Yeah, we'd get stuff, we'd get pizza, we'd go to Washington Square Park, just be a bunch of, you know, kids.
Yeah, be a 17-year-old.
But that was, I mean, even younger than that, like, my parents used to take me in on, you know, a regular basis to go eat and go see Broadway shows, and, like, so it was always, there was always this confusion in my head of why we would go there to have all this fun, but why we didn't live there.
Right.
I never understood that.
And your parents were like, you enjoy having a backyard and space, right?
I mean, sure. Yeah, but when I was a kid, like, again, I didn't get why we didn't live there. But I remember there was a Joe Jackson video for Stepping Out where it's all scenes of New York City.
Yeah.
And that was one of the early videos on MTV. And I remember that coming on. Oh. And just watching that and being like, I want that. Like, yellow cabs and Central Park
was it. I mean, I grew up in the suburbs of Philadelphia.
Right.
And New York, like, Philly was like, that's nice. But New York was always the magnet, the beacon. Now, your grandfather was a duck farmer.
He was, indeed.
Did he raise ducks out in Long Island?
Yeah. No, we have a big old duck farm out there.
I love how you say that. So, like, yeah, of course we had a duck farm in Long Island.
Yeah, I mean, well, Long Island ducks are a thing, you know? I mean, I think there's only one or two at the most duck farms left on Long Island, but it was a thing back then.
So how did how did your grandfather get into duck farming? And two, was that your earliest introduction to being like, there's a connection between here's a live animal and then this is going to be on a plate later?
Well, I mean, they my great-grandparents moved here, and then, you know, they basically settled down in Patchogue, and they built their houses from scratch, literally. Like, there's photos of them digging foundation and laying brick, and then that's that's when they all decided to go into business as farmers, which was great because they didn't have to go to the war, and they were here to, you know, to farm, and that was the plan, that was the chosen path. Now, how that played into food and, you know, and my life was more the fact that, you know, we're a big Italian family, and
yeah,
that always revolves around food. And, you know, like my grandmother was the kind of grandmother that if you came to the house, no matter what time of day, you know, it's like that scene in Goodfellas when, yeah, they all show up to get the knife, to get the hoof, and she's dead, and next thing you know, they're sitting there and there's a table of food. It's really like that.
That's
like,
so
you
amazing.
Couldn't get out the door without having food. It was not an option.
You'd have to really,
no matter what it was,
plan your eating before and your visits.
Yeah,
because you had to, I'm sure you couldn't just sit down and have like, I'm not gonna have a bite. You really have to.
Yeah, no. And she had this thing. There was this hilarious thing my grandmother used to do. She had this thing where she wanted to plump us all up. So I had this sense memory moment where I when I'm at the restaurant and I get to work, I always eat granola and some yogurt and some berries to start my day. And someone didn't order yogurt, or we used it to make something, whatever. And we were waiting for the yogurt to get there, and I'm like, I gotta have my granola. It's like part of my routine. And I was like, fuck, and there's no milk. I'm like, there was only heavy cream, and I was like, that's gross, but fuck it.
Oh my god!
So I put a little heavy cream on my granola, and I had a bite of it, and I was like, it was like that Ratatouille moment where
yeah.
And I was like, whoa, wait a second. I got on the phone. I called my mom immediately. I was like, Mom, did Nanny used to put heavy cream on my cereal instead of milk? And she's like, oh, yeah, she used to do that all the freaking time. I'm like, I just had granola with heavy cream in it. I was like, holy cow, this tastes like the cereal my grandmother used to make.
And then the next call is to your shrink being like, we can skip the next month because I figured a few things out. I got it. It was the heavy cream. It's like, I'm running when I'm a kid, but I don't understand. The weight won't go up. So at what point did this, you know, you see your grandfather, they're raising ducks, their hospitality, the food. When did you start thinking, like, maybe this is the life path I want to go down?
My uncle, who married into our family, married my mom's sister. So his brother has a restaurant that's still in Long Island.
Shout it out.
It's called Varney's.
Okay.
It's awesome.
Awesome.
I still hit it every time I'm home. It is, you know, the New England style, New England style seafood shack. So it's like, you know, mussels, fried fish sandwiches, broiled mako, and like, you know, shrimp cocktail and things like this. And it's, and like the best clam chowder and
all from scratch.
Yeah. And it, like, I remember there was this one, there was this woman that used to bring picked blue claw crab meat every like Tuesday and Friday or something like that, and that's all she did. Like, her husband would crab, and then she'd sit at home and pick, and she'd show up and have like two quarts of crab meat, and we'd buy and do the broiled crab meat. Or, I mean, so that it still exists. It's awesome. And that said, I was 14. My uncle was working there, and they opened up on Sundays. And so my mom, they needed a dishwasher, so my mom put me in the.
Put you in the game.
Put me in the game. She said, "Franny, you're gonna go to work for your uncle." I said, "Okay, that's cool." I was totally game for that. A couple of my friends had jobs and they started making their own money. I was like, "Okay, this is gonna be cool. Now I have my own money." And then Sundays got busy and they needed an extra cook, and I was starting to pick things up. So they kind of slid me onto the grill, and I was like doing a little grilling when I was like 15. I'm like. But I would say by, like, you know, in the first month or even the second week, I was like, okay, this is awesome.
This is awesome.
Rock and roll music playing on the radio. We're
right.
Cooking food. Like, just hanging out with my uncle. Like, that was, I was like, I can just do this for a living. Like, I never liked going to school and taking classes. I was always trying to figure a way out of that.
Yeah. And you're like, this seems mom approved.
Yeah.
Family business.
And I could do this for a living. This is great.
So then when did... So you're 14, 15.
Yeah.
At what point did you make the decision that, you know, Sundays were going to turn into your entire life?
I don't know. That was... It was weird because I always liked cooking after that. Then I started working at the Bellport restaurant, which was a very big influence on me. And I met Chef Taylor Alonzo, and Taylor is one of my mentors in life. And, you know, as you know, chef and friend. And and that's when I started seeing like some more fine dining kind of stuff and some serious technique. And then I really started pushing to do that. Then at one point I remember having three different jobs all around Bellport. I was working at an Italian restaurant, I was working at a cafe, and I was working at the Bellport all the same time. So I feel like that's kind of when the decision started.
Yeah.
I
was, and the family was behind it.
Yeah, I was making my own money, and they got to come to my restaurants and eat food, and yeah, of course they were behind it. I don't think they knew. That was kind of before, it's kind of funny, that's before Kitchen Confidential came out.
Sure.
So they kind of had an idea of what happened in restaurants, and I'm not saying the restaurants I worked in at the time were those early New York City restaurants that were a little gritty. I do remember my grandfather read that book and wanted me out of the restaurant business.
Really? He had the opposite, more visceral reaction to
it. He was like, okay, no.
He's like, you don't want you doing, like, elephant walks of doing drugs down the bar and like that.
And then when I said I'm moving to Manhattan, there was another foot put down. It was like, no, you're not going to Manhattan. What are you, crazy? And like,
but
that,
you,
that
you,
was
you
a thing.
You took me there. You took, you guys,
exactly. You guys started this.
You guys started this. if you guys didn't want to go to Manhattan, we should have been going there on the weekends and showing me all that stuff. You should have taken things out of the house.
So I did. I moved to Manhattan. I think that's when it really happened. That's when, like, when I started seeing that kind of food, when it was the first job I could get, because back then there was, you know, there was a lot less cooks. There was stronger, you know, the kitchens were, it was harder to get into kitchens. It was harder to get a restaurant job, much harder. And I had hit the pavement for like weeks and I just couldn't find a job and I needed like to pay my first month's rent.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh my goodness, what am I doing? I called an old friend who had breezed through Bellport at one point, but I knew he lived in the city, and he had a job for me in Jersey City. So my first job was commute. I used to live in Astoria. I would commute all the way through Manhattan down to World Trade, take the path over to Jersey City, and walk to a place that I think is still there. It's called the Iron Monkey, and that was like my first job. Was like, you know, a 2.5 hour commute from Astoria.
Yeah, you want to talk about a reverse commute
to working in Jersey?
Yeah. Well, listen, we're gonna take a quick musical break because I know for a fact that your pedigree of where you cooked in New York gets a lot stronger.
Yeah.
For anyone who knows
this,
your career,
this is kind of where it started. Though.
It started. But we're gonna take a quick musical break. Hear some live music from one of our past bands on Snacky Tunes here live on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
If you're facing a judge with a fistful of drugs, all accomplices fled from your sight, the responsible one feels the wrath, takes the brunt of it all with a false sense of pride. The papers all follow you from town to town. Your exes all forward the mail. For 36 moons, little food on her plate. She's an outlaw in the salty state. If you're still up at dawn, feeling trashed like a pawn in a game all the animals play, light a candle to pray, light the bowl and relate to the wild ones, the witches and slaves. She fought for a freedom that doesn't exist. What's wrong with these people? She cried. Just 4 years ago, when her case is dismissed, we'll drive round the border of life. The shackles will fall to the ground. Released from the spell for a while. Her record was cleaned by the maid. Don't punish a made up mistake. Two things to choose, either jail time or blues. The latter choice must make you stronger, be it one state or more. If you don't know the laws, your sentence could stretch on forever. The bright side of torture is stories for days. The skeletons out of the closet. The music is soothing, inspiring to boot. The slow-moving sweet dissonance. The shackles will fall to the ground. From the spell for a while. Her record was cleaned by the maid. Don't punish a made up mistake.
Welcome back. We're sitting with Francis J. Derby of The Cannibal. But before The Cannibal and after Jersey City.
After
Jersey City, you had your pedigree of where you cooked in New York is impressive.
So the Jersey City job was the one that kind of propelled me into that. I was working for this guy named Asbel, and we had this conversation about the guy I was replacing, why they were hiring me. He's like, yeah, I saw this guy Fry out on the line, and I've never seen anything like it. I just had to jump on the line, and he's like, that's who you'll be replacing.
He had a meltdown?
Yeah, a total meltdown. Like, just forgot how to cook, and was standing there just
throwing,
like,
his shoes in the fry basket.
Yeah, doing weird shit. Yeah. And so he's like, and I was cooking for a very good friend of mine, doing a tasting, and that friend of his happened to be Paul Liebrandt.
Who?
Yeah, Paul Liebrandt. I had already had this weird connection to, because the guy I was, a good friend of mine, I was supposed to move to the city with, was a bartender at Atlas. So.
What was that like?
Atlas?
Yeah.
Awesome. So that was the real deciding factor, was when I walked into Atlas.
Right.
To do, I just basically wanted to work in that kitchen, and I went there and, started staging there on my days off, and basically I would have, you know, my 2 days off, I would go work at Atlas on those days. That was the first time I'd seen food like that, and that was a decision.
Can you just say, for people who aren't familiar with Atlas, what was the food like?
Oh yes, the food at Atlas was really, really like avant-garde, you know. It's not far off from what Paul Liebrandt cooks today, but
yeah.
He was 23, and that was 17 years ago, and that didn't exist in New York.
Yeah.
Especially not on Central Park West.
No.
At that price point, I don't even know if that restaurant would survive in that area nowadays. But the execution was so perfect, like, you couldn't deny that what Paul was doing was amazing. I had this other side of me that we haven't spoken about, and that was the fact that the other thing I was hoping to accomplish by moving to the city, if it was not cooking being the job, not mm-hmm. the career path, was to be on Broadway, to get an acting career together.
Really?
Yeah, no, I literally voice training, acting coaches my whole life, dancing, the whole nine, since I was like 6 years old.
I had no idea.
Yeah. It was
favorite musical.
Oh, that's tough. I don't know. Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum's a good one.
Fantastic.
I
guess you did mention in the first part you did go to Broadway shows. But,
went to a lot of Broadway shows.
But to me, I just thought that was your parents dragging you.
I was super hyperactive as a kid, and there was a dance studio behind our house, so my mom was like, "Here, you guys take them for
you
an
take
hour."
Them.
And it was one of those things like where I hated going, but the second I got there, you couldn't get me out of it.
Right.
Like I'm like, no, I want to stay. So,
I mean, so then New York had everything you wanted.
I was taking, so I was taking these, this was when the decision happened, really. I was at Atlas, and I was taking these, I was taking classes at K. Michael Patton, and which was a pretty good studio.
Oh, my God.
And,
I mean, you were really in it.
Yeah, no, I was in it. And I was auditioning, I got, several callbacks for Stomp when I got there, because I used to play drums as well, so, that was kind of really up my alley, and so then Paul Lebrand offered me a job. He basically, middle of service one night, he's like, "Do you want to come work for me?" And it was really on the spot. And I was like, "Yeah, I would love to. I have, I have Tuesdays and Thursdays, I have my acting classes, and I might have to take off for auditions sometimes. Is that cool?" And he said, "Absolutely not."
Yeah.
"Absolutely not. You make the decision." And I was like, "Fuck, what do I do? And I said, "Okay, fine. Done." And that was it.
That was it.
That was pretty much it. I was like, you know what? Forget it. I've been doing both of these for a very long time. I'm so passionate about this food thing. I've found myself in this amazing position of being right in the thick of it. And that was not going the same for me on the other end. That wasn't I was meeting all these producers and directors and making friends with a whole ton of actors. I was actually just thinking about food the whole time. So
wow. So you can really define your life path at this one moment.
Yeah. That then was how I met Sam Mason. And
I'm sorry, who?
Sam Mason.
Hi, Sam.
That's how I met Sam Mason. And then from there, met Wiley Dufresne. And that's when I joined the team of WD-50, and that was pretty much it. That's
the major leagues.
Yeah.
I mean, Atlas holds a very special place for those who are, it's a very, inside baseball foodie,
People that know are like, oh, wow.
Yeah, but WD-50 was, that's...
I still remember the dishes from Atlas,
Yeah.
It made a very big impact on me.
Atlas was before my time, but WD-50 was the meal that I know when my life changed, and there was a tasting menu that my brother and I did for our birthday, and there was the way that I saw food before that,
yeah,
and the way that I saw food after that, and that restaurant has shaped and colored so much of my food world and profession. But what was it like being there and being part of that team?
Part of opening team, which means there was still dirt on the floor. Atlas had closed at that point. Sam was... I was working on Long Island again just to kind of get by for a little bit while I was trying to find my next move in New York, and Sam was like, "You're going to come work at WD-50. And I didn't know anything about Wiley yet or any of his food, and I had not had his food or seen it, and I was like, "What if he doesn't hire me?" He's like, "Don't worry about it. He will. And I approached Wiley and basically said, "I'd like to be your opening garmage." Even though I can roast meat, cook fish.
Sure.
At that point, I've been cooking for a while at that point. Maybe not at that level, but I felt like I can hold my own. That said, I still wanted to start at the bottom. And his reaction was, he's like, "I got to tell you," he's like, "I've had a lot of people come and ask me about a position here, and they all want sous chef and meat roast, and I'm not a single person's come up and asked me for Garmager. I was like, well, Garmager is kind of like my thing. Like, I adore that work. Like, that stuff is important to me. And then, it was basically on. Like, I was one of the very few people at Wiley's apartment recipe testing. It was the first time I was introduced to his style of how he pulls things from people. Meaning, like, literally, I think the first day I met him, it was at his apartment. They were working on the corned duck, and there was two versions. One was seared, one was not. One was seared, one was poached. And he puts them in front of me. He's like, which one do you like better? And I'm like, what?
What? I'm sorry. I'm sorry, you're asking me?
Like, you actually want my... He's like, yeah. He's like, I was like, I like this one. He's like, interesting. He's like, that's the one, you know, Sam likes that one. I actually like this one. He's like, but there's no right or wrong answer. It's just, which one do you like? And what do you think would go with this? And I'm like, I don't know, maybe some sort of a dried fruit situation. He's like, oh, we got that dried cranberry mostarda in the fridge. Let's try that. And I was like, whoa, this is crazy.
Yeah.
You know, coming from chefs that were just, this is
how you do it. You're like, yes, chef. So from there, you know, you were at W50, you helped Sam open Taylor,
mm-hmm.
and then you wound up working at Momofuku Sambar mm-hmm. for David Chang.
I did.
Which I remember when that opened and when it was a burrito place, and then it shifted.
That was the Taylor days.
The Taylor days when it was a burrito place, and my cousin used to live around the corner, and we'd walk over your burritos, and then it became what essentially was like not the start of the empire, but that flip of what it became.
Yeah, well, there was that cool thing about, you know, when Dave started building the team, and he you know, that was like the early Tin Ho days where
mm-hmm.
they started making like veal head terrines, and you can only have it after 12 at night.
Yeah.
And then they started doing the chawamushi with the snails, and it was like this kind of like, what's happening over there right now? And like, you knew when you went there on the late night, which is when all the chefs would go there, you knew you were going to see something that no one else was doing in the city. And some of it was like really cool classic stuff, and some of it was kind of fun, like more experimentational stuff. Like, that's when they started the oyster with the kimchi consomme, and like, and that, you know, that started, that was a new style at that point. It was this, you know, you're having food from all these guys that worked in these high end places, but next to, you know, a can of OB beer, and, you know, in that environment,
it was like the beginning of like the new club of New York. But importantly for you, you met Corey Lane were there.
Yep, that's when I started working with Corey.
Yeah, and from there that led to you joining the Cannibal team.
I worked with Momo for a while. It was, you know, that experience for me was incredible. That was the, you know, I was chef de cuisine of the opening of Taylor. Taylor was a little bit of a different... I mean, it was a much different restaurant. And Taylor was like
its own thing.
Tasting menus. It was very, you know, it was very fun. We were hitting that fine dining thing. We were both coming out of the miso butterscotch. I might put that on the menu here. If Sam will give me the recipe, I can't remember.
You know what? I have the recipe.
All right. Great.
Sorry, Sam.
So
you get over to the
camp. We'd come from WD. I'd come from Spain. We'd come from, you know, that style. And then, you know, being thrown into this new world of this was the first time I'd seen a machine like that. Like, I mean, I went from doing, you know, a lot less covers, a lot more focus on plating and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then into like just push, you know, just and that was a big deal, because now it's like that was something I'd never seen. It's something I didn't come from.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that's a totally different monster, and that starts teaching you actually just how to run a fast pace, high pace, high energy.
And like, for those who are not familiar with Cannibal, which is still one of my favorite restaurants in New York.
Thank you.
And one of those, like, it feels so much like an insider secret.
Right.
Just when you walk in, it looks like it's a beer shop, and in the back, it's like this insane attention to meat. What is the Cannibal? What's the approach to it? Why does it exist?
Well, for me, you know, I mean, it was easy for it was easy for Corey and I to work together in that style because that's where our comfort zones were, working together, right? Mm-hmm. So if he's on the floor and I'm in the kitchen, the chances of it feeling somewhat like where we came from are very good, mm-hmm. you know? And so I'd signed on and as more of a consultant and wasn't really looking to settle into something like that. Meat and charcuterie were never really my thing.
Especially with you doing the sort of fine dining high-end stuff for the last few years.
And I never really saw myself doing that. But I do like a challenge. They start getting busier and needed a full-time chef at the Cannibal. And I started kind of taking a liking to it because I could have a little fun. It was, you know, almost in the vein of like how Tin was kind of in a silent, in a way. And then when he started at Momofuku, he just started he'd put one dish on and then another dish, and then he snuck another one. And it started kind of like that. Like I was there as a consultant, but I was like, yeah, maybe I'm gonna run this new bulgogi dish, or maybe I'm gonna run. Make a pate and run that, and then it started to like. And I'm like, man, I think I'm starting to dig this. I'm starting to dig cooking in this style again, and that was it. And then you know, I always say it like, it was always meant to be a butcher shop. It was always meant to supply the other restaurants, have a very small menu of some charcuterie house made, do some retail charcuterie, and sell beer. But, you know, you put a chef in control of that and you get a restaurant.
Yeah, and in many ways, I don't want to say it cannibalized Resto, but, you know, it's sort of, you know...
It became the cool kid on the block.
It became the cool kid. Like, you know? Resto was a fantastic restaurant, was a fantastic restaurant.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the people want that fun, that different approach to food. I mean,
there's so many restaurants in New York. There's, you know, look, New York's my home, and it's my favorite place on the planet. There's so many restaurants in New York. There are so many options that even myself, I'm constantly trying to find
the next new.
I want to have my socks blown off one day. I want to walk into a place and be like, whoa, like I haven't had food like this or. You know, that's a hard thing to find. There's a lot of letdowns in that, but at the same time, once in a while you find a place like that, and you're like, wow, and then it gets out to your friend, you know, like, you've got to go here.
I mean,
that is sick.
I mean, that is definitely a recommendation spot for me. That's one where I know that if I send people there, they'll come back and be like, holy shit.
Yeah.
Now, was the idea of blowing socks off new necks the reason? One of the reasons why you decided to open up in L.A.? How did that happen?
So L.A. happened without. I was not part of that conversation. I didn't. There was even a time when I didn't think I was going to be part of this project. That said, as we evolved and as then we opened Hell's Kitchen and I became more of. You know, overseeing the two places in New York, it just LA can't happen. You know, you can't bring a brand of something that we've totally created with all without the key players.
Sure, of
like,
course.
It wouldn't have worked.
You get out here and you're like,
there's no way I could convey to another chef like, hey, just do this and it'll be
cool.
Pretty much the same thing. It just would never work. It was never my intention to move to L.A. I am happy I got to spend time here, though. It's L.A. It's California. It's Southern Cali. You know, there's oceans and it's great. And the food scene out here is great.
It's awesome.
I have
there's a reason why Lucky Peach did a whole issue on
that. I saw that. There's this part of it that. I don't know that really exists in New York, unfortunately, and that's this. When I got here, I felt like a lot of the chefs were just, well, like, hey, welcome to town. Like, almost like showing up with housewarming gifts even. Like, you know, Bruce Coleman showing up and just bringing me a bunch of pasta and being like, hey, welcome to town. and like bringing his crew here on a regular basis and just to check in and see the progress and be like, hey, you come, you know, come to this event. And like, it was really easy to make a lot of chef friends here. It doesn't feel like competition. It feels like everybody's just so stoked to have more people, more talent, more places to go, more food to see. And I feel like that about the cooks out here as well.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I feel like a lot of the cooks are, they're just like, they're hungry to learn. And this being a new restaurant, a new place that, you know, it doesn't really exist here. They're happy to be here and learn. And that's pretty cool.
It's really awesome. And if having the place in LA wasn't enough, you guys just opened up another place back in New York.
Yeah, so unfortunately, we did have to close Resto, but the reason for that is because we've had this other concept that we've wanted to do. It's a kind of, you know, it kind of completes the brand. Not that the brand is totally complete, but in the sense of like, strengthening what it is that we're doing, we kind of keep adding on to what we're doing. And
this is the Cannibal Liquor House.
So
right?
Yeah, the Cannibal Liquor House. So this was our opportunity for us to do basically cocktails and be a little bit more forward in booze and have the whiskeys and have some fun with it. Do some punches and some milkshakes, some boozy milkshakes, and like that kind
of
stuff.
All while being able to get some of the similar dishes.
What's that?
All while being able to...
Now that was the challenge to me, is like what's different about the food there than and I didn't want to cross over. I didn't want it to just seem like we were just doing cannibal food there because that's what we do.
Because Cannibal's known for its awesome beer program.
Right, beer program, charcuterie.
Sure.
So I don't really do charcuterie, or you can't walk in Liquor House and get a ham board or a salumi board or a cheese plate.
Yeah.
To me, this is more about like a fun version of bar snacks and things that you would eat in pub. You know, like we have Yorkshire pudding on the menus that comes with, you know, a braised veal cheek, so that it's like, you know, snacky Yorkshire pudding, spread the gravy on there. We do burgers there. We do a burger in LA, but we've never done one at the Cannibal in New York. We have three different burgers. Well, we have four different burgers. Four if you include brunch. So like brunch, we do a breakfast burger. It's got fried egg on it and hollandaise, and we do a burger that's a, you know, the dry age, 8 ounce dry age. We do a more what I call the every burger, which is the special sauce, lettuce, tomato, onion, pickle, thin patty, American cheese, yeah. more like you know, with the
classics.
Yeah, that kind of classic. We do another one that's just all birds, that we basically use a pâté farce for. So it's chicken, duck liver is the patty, and then it gets a 3 ounce torchon of foie gras on top,
sure,
with quince jam, and we call that the burger.
Well, that in a Manhattan should be called the Francis J. Derby.
Yeah.
In honor of the dad. Well, listen, thank you for taking the time. Congratulations. You know I'm a big fan.
Yeah, man, it's great, you know, and it's great to reconnect out here in L.A.,
awesome. And where can people find more information about the restaurants?
Our emails, I think it's Cannibal LA, Cannibal NYC.
You guys have good Instagram games too.
I think it's important.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like that's often how I'll pick a restaurant.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, what was that photo I saw the other day?
Although I won't say the restaurant, but there was a dim sum place where they did a good photo, and I went in and I got totally burned. It was absolute crap.
Bummer.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I'll make sure to swing in for the happy hour, which is totally awesome out here.
Yeah, you know, just boards of charcuterie and, you know, chicken wings and little bar burgers. And
awesome.
I mean...
Just don't tell my doctor.
Okay.
Yeah.
Deal.
Yeah. All right, well, we have another quick musical break and then some live music coming up here on Snacky Tunes on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
look like someone who is good at everything. The work that you put into it is worth something, they said, but that's just it. It's sort of hard to say what's one thing or the other. Either way, you get exhausted and deflated. Everyone says it's okay, but what do they know? Milestones are overrated. Our souls are paper thin, we're running out of clever thoughts. It's getting old, we are in empty beds, floating down a river all alone. I hate to break it to you, kid, but you are never going home. And still you try and try to find another way. Still you die when they look you in the eye. You wanna climb up on a ledge, tape your last wishes to the fridge. Well, I don't wanna think about it, I don't wanna think about it, I don't wanna think about it, I don't wanna think about it. I should feel ashamed, but somehow I don't feel ashamed. I feel an overwhelming nothing. I feel nauseous and disgusted. Feel lightheaded and estranged from life. Feel lonely and insane. Feel like watching television for eternity until I shrivel up. If God is smiling on you, he must be smiling on me too. Can you admit that makes no sense? Not even for a second. I ask you how you are, you're stressed. Ask about your day, a mess. I ask you what you plan. You said you're settling for second best. And still you try and try to find another way. Till you die when they look you in the eye. I know it's hard to hear, but you're the loser of the year. And I don't want to talk about it, I don't want to talk about it, I don't want to talk about it, I don't want to talk about it. You, well, I would run. If I was you, yeah, I would run. So far away from me, so far away from me. If I was you, yeah, I would run. If I was you, well, I would run. So far away from me, so far away from me. If I was you, well, I would run. If I was you, well, I would run so far away from me, so far away from me, and start again.
Have you tasted the world's best cheese? Grand Cru Sauchois is the 2016 World Cheese Champion. Our partners at Roth, Wisconsin make this gorgeous alpine-style cheese in the rolling hills of Greene County, Wisconsin. Grand Cru Sauchois is produced by hand in Swiss copper vats and finished by aging on spruce planks. The quality milk and careful craftsmanship bring out the award-winning light floral notes, nutty undertones, a hint of fruitiness, and a mellow finish. Perfect with Riesling and Muscat, Grand Cru Sauchois is a guaranteed hit for any occasion. Check out their other offerings at rothcheese.com. You'll discover Buttermilk Blue and their newest release, Prairie Sunset, the golden-hued love child of Mimolet and Gouda. You'll also find recipes like the Raclette Reuben and tomato tartlets. Everything you need to know about the world's best cheese is at rothcheese.com.
I would like to welcome to Snacky Tunes, Lucius.
Thank you.
Hey, hello.
There's five of them, and just so it does not go to waste, they're all dressed in gender-specific matching outfits. Welcome to the show. Thank you. I was telling some of your boys that I saw you play at Hamageddon at Googa Mooga.
Oh.
And drew me in across the field. And then I was like, oh, these guys are great. And then, lo and behold, Girly Action, of course, works with you. And they sent you our way. And here you are.
On a We're happy to
kind
be
of
here.
Overcast, gray, December-ish day.
Yeah. But surprisingly warm.
Surprisingly warm.
Yeah.
So I want to start with the house in Ditmas Park. Because... Mm-hmm. I had only recently learned about its Victorian secrets, and I want to know how you found the house and, you know, where it seems like that's kind of where it all began.
Well, Holly and I had been singing together and writing before then, but we found the house on Craigslist, and we were just looking for a place with a bunch of friends, and we knew nothing of the house's history through the Craigslist posting. And we showed up, and we had already lost a house that we really wanted to have, so we were sort of weary of the situation. Like, we didn't want to get too excited about something that was not going to happen. And we showed up, we walked through the front door, and there's, like, vintage organs and a grand Steinway piano and a recording studio in the basement. And it was sort of like, what? Yeah. What kind of dream did we step into?
What was the working order of all the various working order? It all kind of worked, or?
We just needed to tune the piano, and everything was... Yeah, yeah, it was working.
There was a couple pianos in the house that were, like, from the 1800s that definitely were not working. But, I mean, it was pretty magical.
Pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Did you just were like, we'll sign right now, we don't care?
Yeah. Well, then we saw the rest of the house, and it was just, yeah, it was sort of...
Like, we have to make this work. Also, there was tons of records in the basement, but clearly, like, the landlords didn't know the importance of all this stuff.
Right.
They didn't even mention it in the Craigslist ad. So when we moved in, all the records were gone.
Yeah, 3,000 records. He just threw them out. He didn't sell them on eBay or anything.
You asked him?
Yeah. Because we're like, where did they go? Oh, threw them out. They're old records.
Like, you just, they just had no idea.
But all the gear was still there.
Yes.
Yeah.
You were like, please keep the organ.
No, we didn't know. I mean, we just didn't know that he was even considering moving anything.
Oh, you just took it as an omen, less like, hey, this will be left here. So,
yes.
How did those instruments begin to factor into the band?
Well, we started writing on the piano and met a bunch of neighborhood friends, including Danny and Pete. And
who are in the band? People can't see that you're looking around, but they're
in
the band.
Yes, Danny, Pete, and Andy. And we just started hanging out and having like little jam sessions and writing on our front patio, and that's sort of how it began.
Okay, well, why don't we hear a song first?
Sure,
let's do it.
This is called "Wilder Woman." It's an unreleased track.
She's a wilder woman.
Nipping out the pages in your book. Oh, we're gonna find an early way back home. Written in our blood, oh, it's written in our bones. Yeah, we're only being bound, by the things we choose. Yeah, we'll only be bound, by the things we choose.
Amazing.
It's really funny to watch all these people.
I know. So you see, it kind of like answers your question. Like the people at the table by the window, they hear it. The people that are further out, like they kind of hear it.
Okay.
Like when you get loud, they're like, what?
But they can see us, obviously.
Kinda.
Oh, they just.
It's kind of like it's not a two-way mirror, but just because
they're
the way that's
pictures
lit.
Pictures with their phone and stuff.
Maybe they're taking pictures of their food.
Yeah, I mean,
maybe we should moon them.
Yeah. Hashtag Roberta's hashtag band. I feel like this show is very like stereotypical. Like people could come out of town and be like, oh, of course there's like a radio show and a band playing here or eating pizza. They're like, how Brooklyn, how Bushwick. Oh, and they're all matching in outfits. I mean, like I said, usually my brother is here and we are twins. So people are just like, twin hipsters. Hosting. So it's like just kind of checks the list. Vocals play such a huge part of your band, and I'm curious how that factors into the overall writing process of your song. You know, where do you start? And, you know, where do the ideas come from? And then how do you essentially build the layers of the songs that you make?
Each song is different. I mean, sometimes we come up with a line for a chorus or a part of a verse, and then build around that. Or sometimes we come up with like a vocal little tidbit.
Yeah. I mean, we started writing together really like it was the first time we had really explored with writing about 7 years ago. And we've been lucky because we've had very similar sort of patterns and sort of experiences in our lives that we've been able to relate to one another. And it's made the writing
example?
Process just heartbreak and falling in love and you know, I mean, just even living in the same place, moving to a different place, having to grow accustomed to a different lifestyle. I mean, just those types of things.
Got it. And then, so if it starts between you two, how does the music enter in, and then how do the background vocals as well play a factor?
We're just like, let's do something fun.
Yeah, we like to experiment.
The arrangement process is really collaborative. Danny's a producer, so he comes up with cool ideas when everyone's recording for harmonies and backing vocals and all that stuff.
The thing was, when we recorded our record, we weren't really a band. Holly and I had some songs. We got together with Danny, started recording, brought Pete in to play on some tracks, and we had never played together as a band.
Got it. And then, so the record recorded, and then you're like, you guys want to play in our band?
Basically.
Yeah.
It's like, this makes sense. Let's try this out. And then Andy joined the band.
welcome, Andy.
Thanks.
High five. On air, high five. So then as that came, most bands, you know, they play around for forever. Like, oh, we should record something. And then how did it become, you know, recording the record and then forming a band and then taking it on the road?
I mean, we really... the band is pretty young. It's only about a year old, and our first tour was like 2 months ago, not even. So that's just an opportunity came about. And
where was it?
We went out with J.D. McPherson, who's an incredible rockabilly artist, and Milo Green, who like indie folk band. So all over the Northeast, Canada, and the Midwest.
So, I mean, you guys are essentially band first and now becoming friends type of situation. I mean, most people... Not friends? Okay.
Yeah.
Let's talk, okay, this has got real interesting. Let's talk about it.
No, we met... we all met through this band, sort of, in, you know, we all knew each other through the small community of playing music in the same city, but it did bring us all together, and, you know, we met Andy not too long ago, but Danny had been working with, you know, Andy was playing another band called Annie and the Beekeepers, and
Danny
it was a pretty
their record.
Yeah, so it was a pretty natural progression of how all the pieces came about, and then you learn about, you know, what everyone's stinky underwear smells like along the way, so it's just like...
Because I was like, oh, I think that's my...
Then we really
no
fell in love.
No longer stinky, I just washed it all last night.
Yeah, Holly did it really, I just like,
washed. Holly washed everybody's underwear.
The day we got off tour, she took everyone's clothes and
washed She's like,
them.
You know what, I'm taking this on.
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh, I think that's my bow tie, or I think that's my button-up shirt.
Yeah. My shirts are the ones that are ripping in the back.
The ladies pretty much keep track of where all the clothes are, because otherwise we would leave them in each city.
Is each night a different look, or is it uniform across the whole tour?
It's a different outfit.
We have so many different looks. No, it's
we're really looking to Paris this year, a little bit of Greece, maybe some Milan.
We call this our midnight look.
More like grandma's closet.
Why don't we hear another tune?
Cool.
This
is called Go Home. Yes.
Everybody good?
Mm-hmm.
Lead you nowhere anyways. this on my heart, I will say. Press on my heart, I will say. I don't need you anyway. I don't need you, go. Go.
I guess that one was on a shared experience of heartbreak. Just hoping I'm not reading into that too much. I want to talk about the comp that you made, because Freelance Whales are good friends of ours and good friends of the show. They were on 2 weeks ago. We love them. They actually re-recorded our theme song, and they're the best. But tell me about this comp, like where it came from, how it came together, and
our van was stolen with all of our gear after our show, back in, what was it, July or something. And we had to do a pledge campaign because although the insurance company covered the car, we had about like $20,000 worth of gear that was stolen. And basically just called on all of our friends for help. And through that, we sort of came up with the idea of doing a compilation disc. Friends covering friends' songs, didn't have to worry about copyright, didn't have to worry about any of that. So the Freelance Whales gave us permission to do their tune. They're good friends of ours, and that's how that came about.
Who else was on the comp?
Spring Standard, Sydney Wazer, Elizabeth and the Catapult.
I'm looking at Dana because these are all other Snacky Tunes bands.
yeah.
Jukebox the Ghost.
Amazing. And so did you, were you able to raise the money back and replace all your gear?
Yes.
And so now what, how do you get the comp? Because I want the comp.
Oh, it's a secret, but I will send it to you.
It's a secret?
Yeah, no, it's only to the people that pledged.
Oh, wow.
That was the whole sort of.
And then once it was, you raised the money, it was done?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That's actually really great.
Yeah.
To be kept in the vault for another van that gets stolen.
Yeah.
Full of knock on wood gear and everything.
or in the vault for something positive.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That thing. So, as you know, two old friends and some newer friends and one very new friend, Chatting Road, do you guys get time to explore and eat in the cities that you were on tour with? Do you guys eat well together?
Yeah. Sometimes. I mean, we all like to cook. So, any opportunity we have to just go and get some fresh eggs and make a sweet breakfast. Usually breakfasts are where
to stay with people with kitchens.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we've been staying with friends or like
in our two tour. We've stayed in one hotel in one hotel.
Yeah.
Usually just staying with, so make an announcement on stage. Anybody have a bed for us?
Really?
A floor for us? Mm-hmm.
How does that work?
Well,
they're like, we will cook you breakfast.
You have to go
with breakfast.
You, with none of the shame.
I'll make shakshuka anytime.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Got it.
That's a good. I would let you sleep on my couch. What now? Is a requirement that one of each of you, all five of you, make a dish, or is like, do people usually have just like one dish?
Well, there was Jess and Holly. I just found this out. Our taco masters. You guys made incredible,
we went to really the farmer's market, guacamole.
Oh, yeah.
Like, everything was, like, its own little featured plate, and then I just smashed it all together. Like,
thanks.
Slammed it in your face.
Yeah.
So like, breakfast
really
talking.
Crispy potatoes.
Yeah. Danny's go-to breakfast dish is definitely shakshuka, and that is always a crowd pleaser.
Yeah. It's easy and delicious.
How do you make yours?
Yeah, get on in here.
Get close to that mic.
I've been standing about 10 feet away up until now.
Yeah.
Usually I make some sort of tomato stew, and I'll add some kind of sweet element like carrots or sometimes a little ketchup. And then just let it, like hey, man, it's a food show. We're like...
It's a food show. Let's talk about ketchup.
Yeah.
No, hey, I mean, I'll tell you this. My mom's chicken growing up thought it was the most gourmet stuff ever. Three ingredients of it. Ready? Lipton's onion soup, apricot preserve, and French onion dressing.
That sounds amazing.
And I thought that was like... And I still make it and still pass... Oh, this thing? Hours.
Actually, just before we came in here, Pete and I were talking about all the like dishes that we had as kids that were like kind of symptoms of being like children of the 80s, like salad dressing and chicken legs. Like that's it, just like the worst Italian
that's
dressing.
That's what I thought you were going to say.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, but I mean, but it was kind of like, and I always tried to make it and it never tastes as good. And my mom goes, well, why'd you get it? I was like, well, I got fat free French dressing, you know, and she's like, no, you need to get this shit that's terrible for you in the 80s when we didn't know any better and put that in a pot. And I'm like, oh, okay. And then of course, better.
It's the best thing ever.
All right. So ketchup and.
So you make the stew until it like simmers down and a lot of the acidity goes away. And then you just poach eggs on top of it for like 5 minutes. And there it is. Usually, I mean, my dad, he went to the Israeli army, and the way he described it to me is it would always be like whatever vegetables were left over from the night before, like the meal they had. So shakshuka was kind of like a poor man's breakfast. It was like, let's just take leftover veggies, throw it in a pot, throw some eggs on it. But
do you put the bow tie on when you're cooking in the morning?
Do I put the what?
The bow tie on.
Always. Only bow tie.
Only bow tie. Backless apron and a bow tie. So what do you guys have coming up next? The EP is out.
EP is out. We are finishing our full-length record, and we have a big show in New York on January 18th with Tall, Tall Trees at Mercury Lounge.
Amazing. Tickets available now?
Tickets are available now as of Friday.
Great. So do you want to give people the nuts and bolts where they can buy the EP, where they can find you?
It's on iTunes. ILoveLucius.com, LuciUS. We're on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and all those things. And thanks so much for listening.
Yeah. You want to give those keys a test to make sure that it... There we go.
Sweet.
Well, big shout out to the Melt Shop and Spencer, Bullfrog and Bomb. Shout out to Girly Action. Dana, thank you so much. Roberta's, as always. Jack, welcome back from vacation. Joe... The whole crew. We have one more episode left for this year. I believe it's Teen playing live, and I'm not sure the food guest because that's just where I'm at right now in my life. And don't judge me. Thank you so much, guys, for coming. This has been amazing.
Thanks so much for having us.
What's the name of the last song?
It's called Turn It Around, and we actually have a video that came out about a month and a half ago. It's on YouTube for this song. So check it out.
Thanks for everybody listening to Snacky Tunes. Shout out to Darren and Joe and Mom and Dad. And Dad, feel better. See you guys next week.
Feel better, Dad.
about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
For listening.